Welcome to Ever Beyond, 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 Beyond on Wolf Spirit Radio and everbeyond.info. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond, beyond. Greetings and welcome to Ever Beyond. Good afternoon if you're in the States, good evening if you're in the UK, and good morning if you're in the Far East. And what a lovely March the 16th it's been. It's been a bit kind of drizzly and grey, but I've seen some amazing pictures of Arctic aurora and things. The sky is actually literally green in certain parts where it's not too cloudy. And very appropriately for St. Patrick's Day, which it happens to be here in the Celtic lands of Britain. And I just so happen to have a guest who is on the Emerald Isle itself. He almost needs no introduction, but I'll introduce him anyway. He's an artist. He's a great thinker. He's a broadcaster. And he's Thomas Sheridan. Good evening. How are you?
Hello, Jay. Good to be here, and happy St. Paddy's Day to you and your listeners.
That's marvellous. So, you have a thing. Everybody's got their thing, and your thing is recognizing that we're part of a psychopathic society, and that we're run by psychopaths, and the only way to get anywhere in the society is to be a psychopath, or you just end up as the brunt of them. So, can we draw any parallels between the story of Saint Patrick and any mythologies around that woven into your particular area of study?
Whoa, what a heavy question to begin with.
Can we? Would you like to start with some ice cream?
Depending on which side of the fence you stand on, this could be pure dynamite.
Oh yeah, I have to say. Let me just say. You know, on Wolf Spirit Radio, we do allow controversial issues are kind of normal. We're kind of beyond all the BS, and we like to get right down to the heart of things. The wolf looks at what's real, and so. Whatever is real, we're prepared for it, Thomas.
Well, fair enough then.
Having said that, on you go.
Okay, well, St. Patrick was a real person. He actually existed. He's not like one of these mythological saints. He actually is a real person. We have his books, his biography, well, the Vatican does in their libraries, and their letters by him. Now, Patrick comes from, it's Welsh for patrician. So he was a Roman patrician. He was a Roman citizen. He was not a... He would have considered himself a Roman. He would not have considered himself Welsh or English or whatever. He came from that coast. They're not sure which, if he's Welsh, English, or from that part of the world. But he was definitely from that part of that side of the island of Great Britain. He was first taken to Ireland as a slave, captured during a raid. See, the Irish were the Irish back then were attacking Britain a lot. It was the other way around because they were plundering the Roman resources. In fact, the nation of Scotland comes from an Irish tribe called the Scotty. So the Irish were very warlike. They were very much like the Vikings. There's a lot of that kind of element still going on. Well, not, it was before the Vikings, but we had a lot of that kind of thing going on here, raiding parties. He was brought over and he had some kind of religious experience while he was out as a shepherd boy. This is the myth. He got back to England, but when he got back, he somehow And we're told he had a mission to go to Ireland to convert it to Christianity. Now, that's impossible because, for starters, he would have happened to be a member of the elite to get that kind of backing from the church, to get that kind of backing from the Roman imperial structure in Britain. So therefore, he was no humble shepherd boy. He was absolutely a bureaucrat. He was absolutely a member of the ruling class. He was absolutely a Roman who was going there at the time not to convert Ireland to Christianity, but to actually bring Ireland within the Roman system of government. This was a big issue at the time. Ireland was never conquered by the Romans, and we developed our own legal systems outside, as well as other kinds of systems, particularly religion, outside the Roman mandate. Now, when Patrick came back, we get this story that he went to the hill of Tara on Beltane, and there was nobody supposed to light a fire during this festival, and he lit a fire, and apparently that began a conversation with the High Kings, and the next thing you know, Ireland converts to Christianity. Well, this is absolute rubbish. There's no way in hell that he would have got away with that. The first thing, he would have been instantly killed. So it's most likely that this is all allegory. He came over with a bag of money, a huge bag of money, and he did the exact same thing that the British did in India. He just paid off the Irish chieftains and kings and, you know, and so forth, and brought them into this system, and part of the deal was to become a Christian. And he never really liked Ireland, and in fact, when he wrote letters back to the popes at the end of his life in Rome saying that the Irish would never be forced to become Christians because they just do not like the Roman way, and he complained about things like the Breton laws, which was the laws that preceded common law in our, you know, and was still used in Ireland up until the 1600s. It wasn't until the Elizabethan times that it was actually fully removed. But however, that's my opinion of me. I'm not saying he's a bad guy or anything, but he was just doing his job. He was most likely a bureaucrat who came to Ireland to basically bring Ireland into the Roman system, and he was incredibly successful. So that's really what it was about.
Wow. So nothing about snakes.
Well, snakes is an allegory for the Druids. That's what that is. Snakes is an allegory for the Druids. I have a theory about that, actually. I believe that the actual snakes, well, Ireland has never had snakes. There's never been a fossil or anything found. They don't exist here. There's a thing called a slow worm, which is like it's a type of a lizard that has no legs. And if you pick it up, it looks just like a snake,
yeah.
But it's not. It's actually a lizard that's evolved. It's lost its legs, but it's not a true snake. And the snake said, the snake legend is the Druids. It means the druidic bardic tradition, and that's what he meant by that. That was a metaphor. That's what he meant by that. The snakes in my, I have a theory about that. That the druidic religious ceremonies took place in the grove, and if you go to the grove, you will see that there's mistletoe and ivy, wound around the hawthorn trees, and it looks just like snakes. So that's exactly, you know, I believe that may have been the metaphor there, that he drove the snakes out of Ireland, meaning that he drove the people out of the groves where the druidic ceremonies took place and into the churches.
Ah.
So definitely the metaphor in a way.
Interesting. So, okay, so we got that out of the way.
Yes, Brit.
That's brilliant, you know, because, you know, I like to get behind the BS, you know, to find out what the real story was, and, you know, why is there such a big to-do about things, and, you know, how much of that is just a way of distracting everybody so that, you know, we have so many festivals and special days that people aren't able to live in the moment. They keep looking forward and then remembering back, and it keeps people out of the moment. What do you think of that?
Yes, I think there's an element of truth. I think festivals and fests are very important for humans. I think the original origins of festivals were based around the natural cycles, such as the Beltane, you know, harvest festivals, and all the various religious festivals that take place around the production of the harvest, or sort of fertility rites, or the moon. I think they're good for humans. I think that they actually bond us as people. I think that those kinds of festivals, the original purpose of them was to, you know, connect us with the natural world. that we were part of this sort of cycle of nature, and we celebrate that, whether it be in Selin or Beltane or the numerous festivals that Native Americans have based on these natural cycles. So these things are important, and these things, they do serve a purpose, but like everything else, they've become commercialized and they've been taken over, and they're now being used to basically keep us trapped in this sort of like a bells and whistles kind of. There's nothing wrong with having a party, but they seem, it's just like what happened at the end of the Roman Empire. The more the Roman Empire went into decline, the more festivals they had. Bread and circuses.
Yeah, well, that's my kind of thought of it, because, you know, it becomes go ahead.
Like the World Cup or the Super Bowl or the, you know, the Olympics, they're not our festivals. They're completely made up things, you know. So they impose these things on us, that they're our new festivals, but they're not connected to anything except crude commercial things and sort of like a substitute for warrior culture. So it deprives men of actually being men by throwing their, you know, sacrificing their manhood on the altar of Super Bowl halftime ads.
Yeah, we've had several shows on the significance of the Super Bowl ceremonies and all of those little nasty little things that they put on in these shows, which they are, you know, it no longer becomes just a game and a way of bringing people together and working out their differences, you know, like instead of having a war, you have a game of football. But it's kind of, well, we all know.
And these Olympic ceremonies, these opening closing ceremonies and the Super Bowl halftime, you know, quote unquote show, have you noticed they have an increasing sort of religiosity to them? They're becoming more and more like sort of religious festivals, almost going right back to Babylon or something. You know, you watch those Super Bowl halftime shows now, they're literally like Babylonian rituals.
Well, yes, I've had several shows with guest Katie Galanti, who hopefully is listening. Actually, hello, Katie. We discussed the ritualistic elements of that and the way that the powers that be are externalizing their ritual into our everyday life.
Oh, it's terribly interesting stuff. It's even if there was nothing to it, if it was just happening by accident, you know, which I believe it is, but if it was, even on a psychological level, to me it's so interesting and so fascinating that the insight it gives into us as a species at this stage in our development, this is something that people should be all looking into. This is very deep stuff that's going on.
Absolutely. This is the nub of things, really, is the subtle emotional control of the human being, whether it be done through ritual or through repeated brainwashing like TV, or through chemtrail and harp resonance and frequencies and stuff like that. I mean, we researched a lot of that. I'm quite interesting, because what your study is the absolute heart of the matter, and that's the people behind it. Would you like to introduce your, I mean, where did it start? I mean, when there must have been a point. Well, there was a moment, wasn't there?
Yeah. Well, there was a moment. I was 8 years old and a car bomb went off in Dublin. Three of them went off and killed over 30 people. And they were loyalist car bombs, allegedly, that went off, and I was very close to them. And I can still remember the smell of burning rubber and people screaming to this day. That was a point where I became conscious as a child. I stopped being a sort of an, you know, I remember that was the point, that was the moment in my life where I became actually conscious of my existence. That beyond like the child thing, playing with games and reading comic books and kicking footballs around in the neighborhood I grew up in, that was a shock to me. But it was also exciting. It's funny when you're a kid, you know, it's like that film Hope and Glory, I think it was called, about World War II in Britain. The kids were actually all as well as being terrified of the war, they were also having, it was also exciting, because it was like a child can't process those emotions properly. But I do remember, like, for years afterwards, playing on me, couldn't understand why someone, what was the rationale for doing that? How does blowing up, you know, women and children out doing an afternoon shopping and putting the bombs right beside the bus stops, what kind of person does that? And, you know, it's just that, so that's what it is in my head. And I was always, I never understood that. I never understood cruelty. I never understood, you know, nothing made sense to me. So I woke up very early, very, very early now that I think about it. And then, you know, I went through life and had a normal life and, you know, I played in rock bands. I went to America, blah, 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 blah. I ended up studying to be a graphic designer, went to work on Wall Street. And then it was just, that's when it was almost like the flower began to open, because I started to see that the world was not really as we were told it was. And there was one day I was with this guy at work and he told me he was a socialized psychopath. He was he was just a normal guy, a bit intense, but he didn't, a psychopath before that was an axe murderer, you know, Norman Bates kind of thing. But he was actually officially diagnosed after he went on a white collar criminal tear. And so that became, what's this stuff? What is this psychopath? Who is this person? So I kept gathering up documents and anything. There was very little information back then dealing with it, and bits and pieces. I think there was a Herbie Cleckley's The Mask of Sanity and that book People of the Lie by Scott Peck, I think it was. They were good, but there was nothing. But the thing started growing. It started to blossom and I started to see more things about it. But they were all academic. They were all academic. But as this happened, it started to unveil things for me. I know it sounds cold, but I started to believe there were two species of human beings on this earth. And for a long time, Jay, I was very, very uncomfortable thinking that, because I kept thinking back to things like the Third Reich and the classification of subhumans and Ubermensch and all that stuff. And it for a long time I lived with that kind of thing. I shouldn't think in these things because you're dehumanizing people. But then it became kind of undeniable to me when the science came out, especially when it got really good science started coming out after the mid 90s and after Robert Hare's book Without Conscience. And what was being described here was an alien species. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. That's what it felt like to me. And then I started to remember people I worked with in Wall Street and a young woman I was in a relationship with when I was in my early 20s that left me in a very strange way. And I didn't feel, well, these people affected me very deeply at almost like a subatomic level. Being around them didn't make me feel right. It just felt wrong energetically. It was almost like my intuition told me a predator was nearby. And sure enough, especially when I read a lot about brain chemistry and also how hormone responses work in the brain, it became, well, here's what's happening here. My intuition or your intuition or our feelings, our body is telling us, it's warning us that there's a predator nearby. It's almost an untapped instinct that our ancestors had in sort of like Neolithic or Paleolithic times, where they could sense of a predator like a saber-toothed tiger or something was nearby. They could sense it, just like animals can sense these things. They don't have to actually see them or hear them or smell them. They can sense it. And I believe that that's what was going on with these psychopathic individuals. So one thing came to another, and then back in 2008, I said I was going to write a book about this, but I was going to do it as a fictional novel because, again, I was still kind of freaked out by the idea of people turning around and calling me a fascist or something, saying that, oh, he's trying to dehumanize parts of the population. So it was to be a fictional novel about psychopathic kind of demonically possessed individuals who lived on Wall Street. And I still might do this book eventually, but I opened up a blog and I started doing sort of like research for the novel, for the fictional novel. And I was amazed how people, I'm talking about people who were sort of like well-educated people. We're not talking about like religious or very religious people here. Were saying to me, oh yeah, they're demonically possessed. I worked with this guy. This guy, he drained me of his energy. He was not a human being. What I looked at wasn't you. And these emails and these PMs were flooding in. And then it just dawned on me, like, well, why doesn't everybody know this officially? You have to kind of stumble upon this information, or unfortunately, one of these creatures to come into your life and ravage it. And so I decided, well, instead of writing this fictional novel, I'll write a basic book, a guidebook, almost like a toolkit that could be understood, that could strip down all the science, all the complex science, also have the people who've been identified in their testimonies and compiled into a book that would be like a toolkit. And the book was called Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. It was released in 2011, in March 1st, and it went on to become literally a cult classic, which surprised me. It became probably the book that people who were, you know, worried if they were concerned they were dealing with a psychopath, it became sort of like the resource that you would get. And I wrote it very carefully. I didn't want to start witch hunts. I didn't want people thinking that every creep or anyone who messed them around was a psychopath. So I wrote, the book is as much a fail-safe device to try and make you, you know, well, maybe it isn't a psychopath. And I listed out all these things to make sure that if you were going to diagnose a person, you'd have to know them for a long time and you'd have to be aware of them and they'd have to have a certain feeling that they would leave in you. And so that was the purpose behind the book, and that's why I'm here, and kind of like a career for me, you know, which is fascinating. And then two books since have come out dealing with the issue of psychopathology, on the social level, and then also my new book, Amble of the Psyche, which deals with control systems within the media, particularly, and in culture. So yeah, it's been an interesting ride, but it's the weirdest thing has happened at the same time too, is that it was almost like a collective unconscious thing. Everywhere you look now, people are talking about psychopathology in terms of politics, in terms of government, in terms of media, in terms of even abusive relationships, things like, or even bullies at work. It seems to be a meme that's caught on. I mean, I'm not saying I'm taking credit for that, but it definitely confirmed my belief that when Carl Jung spoke about artists have an ability to sort of tap into the zeitgeist just before it happens, it confirmed that kind of theory for me, because that, you know, what inspired me to book when I did, and why did I, you know, tap into something that just became very, you know, a mainstream subject very quickly. I do believe there's something happening here, and I do believe it's an evolution issue, and I do believe that human beings for the first time in history are now not looking at each other as Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, rich, poor, black, white, Asian, Indian, you name it. They're now starting to actually see that maybe, just maybe, there's a different species of human beings amongst us, and unfortunately they've coagulated at the top of the control pyramid. So that's basically where I'm at this point.
Well, that's very interesting. One of the feelings that we have, amongst the hosts here, is that these beings, they are, well, I don't know if you've ever seen the TV show Stargate.
Yeah.
You ever seen the one, and they got this kind of little reptilian in their head? That's wrapped around their spine, that controls everything and gives them power?
I haven't seen that one, but I know what they're getting at there. They're talking about the reptilian complex in the lower brainstem.
Yeah.
It's the lowest part of our evolutionary brain. It's the lowest part, it's our primal brain. It's concerned with fight or flight, sexual reproduction, kill or be killed, and it seems to be hyperactive within the brains of psychopaths. In fact, it has to be, because one thing, a very common thing that people talk about with psychopaths, they have a predatory stare. They have this intense stare, and particularly at moments they're in the hunting mode. Now, when I mean hunting, I don't necessarily mean killing or anything like that. I mean when they want something. They want your body. They want your money. They want something from you. The eyes will go into a particular stare, very intense and very piercing, and it doesn't look human. And there was an article in the British Journal of Optometry about it was 2 years ago, and it spoke about, they actually, you know, this is the thing about psychopathology. You have to actually go look in other fields to actually find anything about it. That's why it's been so badly covered by psychiatry and psychology and even neuroscience. But the Journal of Optometry had speculated that psychopaths have these eyes because the lower brainstem the reptilian complex, which is flooded with the hormone melanin, which, funny enough, is the color blue. It's sat, you know, when you think of blue bloods and stuff. But during stressful situations in all humans, another stress hormone called norepinephrine, which is the flight or flight hormone, that shoots up from the lower brain stem. Now, normally in human beings, we have a damper. A normal human being has a damper in the brain, which actually stops the hormone from flooding up into the upper brain. But in psychopaths, that damper is either missing or doesn't seem to work. Now, it's not a brain defect. It's not there for some reason. And what happens is the norepinephrine flies up in behind the back of the brain where the optical cortex is, and that it almost like charges up the optic nerves around the orbital eye sockets, the orbital, the sub and superorbital bones, muscular bones around the eye sockets of the psychopath in such a way, exactly the same way as an animal. So they're literally not a human being when they're in target mode. They're very much more closer to a predator, something along the lines of a feral animal, a feral mammal. But that's where that metaphor of the reptilian in the brain comes from. It comes from the reptilian complex or the OR complex at the lower base of the brain, which seems to be hyperactive in psychopaths. Terribly interesting stuff.
Yeah, well, that's and this is the heart of it, and I'm sure you're aware of the MK Ultra series of projects.
Yeah, the CIA program in the 50s and 60s. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, a lot of that was involving putting people into a state of deep shock, so that they can it somehow people step out of their bodies, and. They can be reprogrammed, or and the programs can be triggered backwards and forwards, and you know become. So it sounds like these two events are going side by side here.
Well, that was a different thing. What the shock does is what they were doing then was creating something called dissociative identity disorder, which is what happens is when the person is being so traumatized psychologically and emotionally by these events, what happens is the brain, well, when we say the brain, we'll say the mind literally splits. And what happens is the shock and the horror, the experience, which the actual person identifies their original personality with, is partitioned off almost into a closed off part of the mind. It still exists. It's still there. But it's closed off into that part of the mind. What happens then is the rest of the mind is open to suggestion. And what they can do is, because the mind has been put into one partition, it can then be put into several partitions. And one of those partitions can be used through things like hypnosis, subliminal programming, and also through neuro-linguistic programming. They can be made into a sort of a program that can be run by a trigger word or a trigger event, or maybe a sexual act as well can do it. And what happens is they almost become robots who run a program. Now, that's not the same thing as a psychopath. They're people who have been absolutely destroyed and attacked and turned into kind of like robots. However, the people who devised the MK Ultra program, and in particular an American psychiatrist whose name I can't remember. He's dead now, so I can say this, and I'm not fond of calling people psychopaths, but I saw this guy interviewed, and he absolutely was a psychopath. He was so pleased with himself with the success of the MKUltra program. He boasted about how successful it was in treating women, and these were like women that were like, who were put through the most horrific trauma. So MKUltra is produced monarchs. These monarchs are not psychopaths, but the evil monsters who created that program absolutely were psychopaths. And this shows you how dangerous they are, because there's no level that they will not sink to in order to gain control or have power.
So let's take it all the way, because these psychopaths, they came from Nazi Germany. So what's the deal? Is it a nation of psychopaths? Are they breeding them?
What happens is, it's a very interesting thing. I covered this a lot in my second book, defeat the demons.
Oh, and hang on, I just have to say that I don't mean that all Germans are psychopaths.
Sure.
Because my girlfriend is listening, and she's from Berlin, and I get into serious trouble. But I'm talking, you know, I specifically said Nazi Germany, so it's the the Nazi side of the Fourth Reich, the Third Reich, the Fourth Reich.
Well, what happens is, when a society goes into a state of chaos, or becomes a totalitarian society, such as Nazi Germany, such as the Soviet Union, such as the Khmer Rouge under Pol Pot, and Mao Zedong's China, particularly under the Cultural Revolution, what happens is you then have a situation where there are no checks and balances. Decency is no longer considered a virtue. There's no democracy. There's no ability. There's no accountability. The laws are changed to allow the greater agenda to override civil liberties. In a situation like this, the psychopath rises to the top very, very quickly. In all fields, the psychopath goes to the top in media, in government, propaganda, science, and the worst, the most ruthless ones, because there's no shackles on them now. They do not have to pretend to be decent. They do not have to pretend to be moral. They can actually do what they want. Someone like Joseph Mengele was a classic example of that. He had no restraints on him. So the psychopath in him just says, great, I can do whatever I want now. And that's what happened with those guys, those Nazis who were brought over for after Project Paperclip to the U.S. They would have been the Nazis the psychopaths in Germany who flourished within the totalitarian regime of the Third Reich, particularly towards the end of the Third Reich when it was in chaos. This is when they would have really come to the fore. And this is what goes on here. It's not that one's become an agent of the psychopaths. It's just that the psychopaths take over. Just like the psychopaths took over during the Reformation and had Catholics and Protestants murdering each other all over Europe. It's the same thing. They're like an infection. If the infection is not cut off through our ability to stop them, watch them, monitor them, and prevent them from flourishing, they rise to the top of the control structure, and they literally infect the entire society from the top down. So that's what happened in Nazi Germany. And it's hard to believe that, you know, the absolute horrors that were committed by, let's be honest here, by millions of Germans took part in this, either through the military and stuff like that. But this is what happens when psychopaths get to the top. Because all of us as human beings, for the most part, are robots waiting to be programmed. That's how most people are. And if you get psychopaths in power, they will begin rules. That's why Hitler targeted the Hitler Youth. That's why Stalin targeted the Revolutionary Red Youth Committees. That's why Mao Zedong, during the Cultural Revolution, had high school students murdering college professors. They start with the young, because the young are easily programmed. The psychopaths know this. This is also why psychopaths are pedophiles. They go for the younger ones, because they can control them. This is what happens. This is why we have to be very careful with this issue and make sure that we have to always have our humanity intact when we're dealing with these guys, because if we take our eye off the goalpost, off the ball, and do not pay attention, this, what I call the psychopathic infection, will literally flourish at the top, and it has horrific consequences for the rest of society.
Indeed it does, because I mean, one of the okay, there's so many questions, you know, let's just want to go back on this, because you know, you were talking about a lot of the psychopaths in government, his name's Leprechaun, he's Chris from he comes from Dublin, is saying a lot of these psychopaths are in the government of Israel now. Bibi Benjamin Netanyahu, does he fit into that little category of yours?
Well, again, I don't name people. I never do that. Unless, you know, they're being convicted in a court of law or something. I have a friend from Israel, and she has no doubt he is. And she knows a lot about the subject, so I'll just leave it at that.
Nice and safe. Very good. That's, yeah. So, Right. So now there's a question from the chat room here. If clinical psychopaths comprise about 4% of the population, why does it feel there are more of them?
Well, they're 4% of the population, but across society. But in most of us, it'll only be 1%. But if you went to somewhere like Wall Street or government, you'd be talking about 10, 15%. Why do they feel like they're everywhere? Because we're being destroyed. There's a condition which I call proto-psychopathology. It's a proto-psychopath. It's someone who's not naturally a psychopath, not naturally inclined that way, but have been made that way. Through media, through programming, through the military. If you got these people, you could cure them. You could probably reform them. Absolutely, in most cases, you will. But they've been made, they're sort of like, they're almost like robots who've been programmed to behave like psychopaths. Or they want to emulate it. But they're generally, at their core, they would be decent people. They would, you just have to get them out of that environment. And, you know, usually when wars happen, things like that will go on, or cutting edge big corporations, you'll have people behaving that way, but they won't believe it's the only way to survive. It's almost like a fear-based thing. It's completely different than a psychopath. A psychopath is afraid of nothing. They're enjoying every moment of it. For them, it's a great challenge. But yes, it does seem that way. But it also seems that way because psychopaths are so unbelievably prolific in the destruction of human beings. One psychopath, you know, you talk about an average psychopath, even in the suburbs, say a suburban psychopath, you know, male or female, by the time they're 70, they probably have destroyed 100 lives easily. That's what, they're just so prolific at ruining the lives of others that it seems like there's more than there is.
Yeah, and also, they would be, I mean, what you'd call an attention seeker, do you think?
Yeah, they're all narcissistic. They're all narcissistic in one way or another. They love attention. This is why I always tell people, if you know a psychopath in your life, you want to get, okay, you'll never out-psychopath a psychopath, but if you want to really get back at them, no contact ever again. You cut them off like you would cut an infection out of your body, like you would suck out snake bite poison and spit it out and never look back, because they are a parasite. We're dealing with a parasite here, ultimately. So that's how to deal with them. No contact. That's the way you'll get rid of them. That's the way you can actually get them out of your lives. And that does piss them off. It does annoy them. So if you want to get some kind of satisfaction from dealing with them, unless you can take them to the courts, but even then they don't care. They see that as attention as well. That's why I'm against these things that they have, like here in Ireland, like these impact statements. These victim impact statements that they have in court, and you have these people, you know, who are raped by pedophile priests when they were kids, telling, you know, Father McGinty how much they were damaged. Father McGinty loves every moment of it. He's sitting there with a big smirk on his face, recalling the great fun he had raping these children. So the way you deal with them is to treat them like you would any. But I mean, I know this sounds harsh language, but to me they're a biohazard. You treat them like you would any biohazard, you quarantine it.
So that's that's step one. Don't feed the psychopaths.
Oh, absolutely. They love it. And don't challenge them. Don't think you can outsmart them. Mm. Don't think you can outpsychopath them. Good God, no. They've had a whole lifetime of practice that a normal human being wouldn't know what would know. It would be like, as I said in my book, Puzzling People, someone with a pea shooter taken on an Apache gunship. Don't even bother. Just run.
What about people who like can't get away from them? You know, they may be your boss at work, they may be your child. Are there ways of kind of emotionally distancing yourself from them so that they don't get to you, and you don't feed them in that way?
I'm not going to tell people how to live their lives, but if someone has a psychopath or a coworker, if possible, get another job. I know that sounds like, you know, a nuclear option or not, but that's the ideal situation. Go get another job. If you can't, specifically if it's a psychopathic coworker, well, yes, there is something you can do. You can start become psychopath aware. You start getting books like My Puzzling People. You bring them into work and you leave them on the desk. You get books like Without Conscience or Snakes in Suits. about workplace psychopaths, and you leave them on your office desk. You start talking about people at work, not the psychopath, but somebody else. About, I read this very interesting book. It's all about psychopaths. You know what they really are? They're people with no conscience who operate in the workplace. If what happens then is the psychopath knows you're not food. They know you're not tasty to them anymore, because you're aware of their mind games and their tricks and their little, you know, specific, you know, little game plans they play to, like, get into your mind and mess with it. That's a way of doing it. 9 times out of 10, that will work. You don't have to, you know, don't go running around the office saying, you know, Bobby Joe, what's his name, is a psychopath. Don't do that. You just subtly be very kind of clandestine in showing your awareness of the subject. And that can be just as much as leaving a book with the title on psychopaths, with the title facing upwards, is enough to put them off. Because one thing a psychopath lives in absolute terror of is being found out. That's the only thing they're scared of. You know, they're really afraid of that. They do not like being found out, because it's end game for them. Then, because then people will figure it out. See, this is the whole purpose of my work. We just make ourselves educated about psychopaths. They won't be able to eat us anymore. It's as simple as that. So, if you have one as a child, again, it's a horror story. I feel bad for any person that has one as a child. Fulfill your obligations. You know, first of all, don't jump to any conclusions. Kids can often be messed up, especially in their teenage years. Even kids can go through a rough time in their teenage years. Don't judge them because they go a bit crazy between 15 and 19. That's normal. But there are signs you should look out for. My second book, Defeated Demons, I cover that quite well. How to keep an eye open on this child. But if you do suspect a kid is a psychopath and behaves like one, well, you have to fulfill your obligation as a parent, and then you have to find a way to try and get them out of your life. I know that sounds very harsh, but they will be nothing but pain for you, or you must limit your contact with them, maybe move to another country or another state, or, you know, try and get them to join the Navy or something. I know it sounds kind of funny, but that's literally what people have had to do to get rid of them. And it's just an awful situation, but don't jump to conclusions. It's very unlikely your child will be a psychopath. But if you can't get away from them, which you should in every case try and get away from them, but if they're a child, you have to fulfill your obligation. But when they reach adult age, I guarantee you, they're always going to be coming back after they've messed up their lives. They're going to vanish for 20 years and you'll never hear of them. They'll come back with like 4 wives and 20 kids. They'll make up all stories that they were in the military. You'll find that they were in prison. And they'll keep coming back, tapping you for money. But when they really will start to come back and target you is when you're old, because they'll want the house or they want the will, and they will literally try and speed up your debt or try and make you believe that you're going senile early so they can move you into the old folks' home and take your possessions.
Wow. There's all my life gone. Oh, I'm glad my kid's not a psychopath. He's a lovely boy. He's very empathic. And this is the thing, you know, it's that's the opposite of a psychopath. And I've often found there is a kind of draw between one and the other. You know, people who are genuinely nice and people who are very cold and controlling.
But see, we have to be careful too. Psychopaths can be incredibly charming. Remember, they've had a whole lifetime to study us as a species. One great way you'll discover someone is a psychopath is when you'll know who the psychopaths and are in your life when you go through a bad time, especially if there's nothing there for you. Like, suppose you had no money and you got cancer. Well, your real friends will be there for you. The people who are just decent people, they'll want to know how you're doing, even if they're not there all the time. But the psychopaths won't have any interest in you, because there wouldn't be anything for them, any reason for them to remain friends with you, because there's nothing you can offer them anymore. To them, you're just an obsolete unit that's about to be removed from the planet. You have a crisis in your life. Like, I watch these things, like these TV stars who get, or film stars who get accused of terrible things, and or anybody really, and they'll always say it was a great gift, because in the end, when it was over, I found out who my real friends were. But the ones who sort of like join in the smear campaigns, the ones who jump on people when they're going through a hard time, 9 times out of 10, they're psychopaths.
Mm-hmm. So, where are they? Oh, I've got the... Yes. So, here's the thing. And it's a question that popped up in my mind this morning as I was thinking about the show, you know. Okay, so how do I know that I'm not a psychopath?
If you're worried about it, if you're concerned about it, you're not. That's the first one. If a person, you know, look on it this way, Jay. We've all done things in our life. We're ashamed of. We've all done things in our life that were bad. We've all done things in our life that we shouldn't have done. But the difference between us and a psychopath is two different things. The first one is we actually will try to make amends for the things that we've done in our lives. You know, if not to the person that we've hurt, but to, you know, maybe if the person's dead or gone, to someone else similar, to try and help somebody, to try and sort of, you know, atone for the guilt that we feel. And the second one is we would be tortured by what we do. We'll go, the rest of our lives we'll be going, I should have never done that. I should have never done that. And also, if we do stupid or bad things, it's usually that because we're not thinking straight. It's usually because we're thinking with our yin yang, or we're being selfish or infantile, or, you know, peer pressure. But a psychopath is nothing like that. A psychopath is a predator. A psychopath is planning these moves. A psychopath is observing, taking notes, compiling dossiers, looking for your weak spots, looking for a place, a chink in your armor where they can destroy you. And then they will walk away after they've done this as if you never existed, as if they changed a channel on the TV or put a new CD in the CD player. It's just business. They're cold and they're ruthless, and they do it on an industrial scale. It's not just one or two people who they've messed up and hurt. It could be hundreds. It could be thousands. This is how they are. So, a lot of people say to me, I was reading your book, and for a few minutes, a few pages there, I was wondering if I was one. Well, that's a common reaction, but it's not just a cluster of a few things. It has to be very specific things all together, but over a whole lifetime, of doing this. So it's like they're nonstop from like the time they're, you know, in their preteens, till they drop dead in the old people's home. They're predators. It does not stop. They're constantly on the make. They're constantly trying to scam or use or manipulate somebody. So that's how you'd know you're not one. If you were like, I shouldn't have done that. Like, I can remember when I was growing up as a teenager, there was a kid and I was playing in a band, and there was a bass player came along, and I wanted this bass player in the band, and, you know, he said he would join, and then I wasn't friends with the other kid who was in the band, but there was already playing bass, and I was so excited about getting this bass player this was a really good bass player. I went to the other kid and I told him, look, I'm sorry, it hasn't worked out this way, but, you know, we got a really good bass player, and, you know, we want to bring him into the band. So, you know, I hope we can still be friends, and, you know, wherever we can still play together. And the guy started crying. And I remember, like, my heart sinking. And to this day, I still feel bad about it. Well, a psychopath would just say, get out. Or wouldn't even tell the other kid would show up and the new bass player would be in. They're just so cold and they're just so ruthless. It's like I said, it's like a different version of humanity. They don't have feelings like that. They don't have compassion.
And compassion and empathy, these are what I believe are the qualities of the human in the future. To be more compassionate, to be more humane, and evolve that way. That's, to me, that's what I believe evolution is about.
Absolutely.
Or at least that's the model of the evolved human for me.
Well, our humanity, what makes us human, is our prefrontal cortex. That's where our creativity, our dreams, our desires, our mirror neurons are, which will actually allow us to bond with people. to allow us to have empathy for people. They're all in the prefrontal cortex, our upper part of our evolutionary brain. Ironically enough, as we started out with the lower brain stem of the reptilian complex, but the prefrontal cortex had a sudden expansion. I think it was about 35,000 years ago, and it seemed to have happened with the growth of art and language. And that's the human brain. That's where it all is. That's where all the stuff is. If you put a psychopath under an MRI scan, the prefrontal cortex is dead.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Now, there's people who are not psychopaths who'll have a damaged prefrontal cortex. Like, I have a friend who fell off a motorcycle, and I shouldn't have this, but he banged the front of his head, and he has the psycho eyes, and he has no sense of smell, which psychopaths have very bad sense of smell, because his frontal cortex was damaged in the motorcycle accident. But he's the loveliest man you could ever meet. He's a sweetheart. I mean, he's a heart of gold. But psychopaths, they have an inactive prefrontal cortex and a hyped reptilian complex. So, and it's very easy to see this under an MRI scan. Now, the thing is that it's not that they're broken. It's not that the prefrontal cortex is damaged or broken or missing. It's all there. Just they don't choose to use it. Like, it's like horses for courses. It's like someone who always drives in fourth gear has no desire to drive in fifth gear. That's how they are. They've noticed that's where prefrontal cortex, where empathy and love and compassion and creativity and dreams and all these kinds of wonderful things that make it, being a human being, a joy. They just don't bother with it. Switched off.
Wow. So yeah, so it's interesting. So there's this link, I've heard you mentioned on this on another program about the thing about the whites of the eyes. I looked it up, and it's Japanese for three whites, as sanpaku. So does this neurochemical situation, does that connect with the way that the lower eyelids go?
Well, that's what I was saying earlier on about the norepinephrine from the lower brainstem. It triggers the optical cortex, fires up the optic nerves at the front of the brain, and excites the muscular contractions around the suborbital bones and superorbital bones of the eye socket. So, yeah, there you go.
You see
the whites in our eyes.
That's it.
No, cowboy expression, yeah.
Don't shoot till you see the whites of the eyes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So beautiful. So where are we? We're 10-2. I've got a track lined up. It's Primal Scream with Damaged.
Great stuff.
Yeah. we'll have that in about 5 minutes' time. It was interesting that after I asked that question, my girlfriend in the chat room said, I asked the question, how do I know I'm a psycho? She said, I will tell you, baby.
There's two, a good woman and a cat will tell you. Cats are phenomenal psychopath recognizers because they see them as another predator. So if you want to have a good detection unit in your house, get some cats.
Yeah.
The cats seem to be very aware of them and don't like them. And this is probably why the Egyptians had a cat in every home. And they considered the cats to be spies of the divine. That they would actually go around looking to protect humans on behalf of the gods. They were like Osiris, and that's what they probably figured out earlier on. The Egyptians, being a very clever people, probably figured out that the cats knew who the psychos were.
Yeah, and probably, as they say, you know, they would go out at night and they would communicate with each other. You know, they'd be howling at each other, but they're probably saying, oh yeah, we got a psychopath at number 23, and, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, they're very intuitive that way. Mm. I've actually got a video on my YouTube channel about it. I was talking to a gentleman on another show in Amman in Jordan, and he's a business guy there, and he keeps cats in the living room for when people he's doing business coming over, so to see how the cats react.
Yeah, sorry, I was just adjusting the fire. It was going out. So the cats are the early warning system.
They're a useful one to have around. Yeah.
I do like cats. You know, a lot of people like dogs, but I'm more of a cat person. The on that kind of sensitivity level of
Yeah, they're clever. It's like, and they're a great ego check for us. Like, as someone said to me a few weeks ago, he said, "You know, only God can judge me." And I said, "We obviously never had a cat."
Lovely. They are very cuddly. But the thing is, you know, like you say, they're a predator, and one you have to be very careful of predators with nice hair, really.
Yeah. Well, you see, it's very interesting. Maybe that's why human beings have cats in the house. Maybe that's why sensitive people keep cats. You see, remember, we've through, you know, domestication of us, the humans, for the last, you know, 5 or 6,000 years, we've lost most of our natural instincts to spot predators. It's almost like evolution has made human beings bring cats into the home as almost like an extension of our own neural network to be the predator spotters for us. You know, so it's very interesting. The stuff is so deep, we can look at it on lots of levels. But I find that human beings are very, you know, human beings have developed their relationship with cats in the last, say, 100 years that I find very interesting. It's almost like, is this part of the battle against psychopaths? Is this part, you know, unfortunately, one of the horrible things is that psychopaths usually start out killing animals when they're young. That's how one of the ways you spot them, and they often will kill cats. And I often think to myself, is that the purpose of the cat being in the life of the human being? Is this nature, evolution, handing us an early warning system to make up or compensate for our predatory instincts that we've lost through domestication?
I bet. And wouldn't it be nice if we had cats the size of
Oh, yeah.
Labradors to look after our houses? You wouldn't get many psychopaths in the area then, would they?
No.
Interesting. Interesting. Great. So I think it's a good time to take a little break. I'm certainly going to go and make myself another cup of tea. I claim to drink tea like an Irishman, apparently. I'm a chain drinker, you know, so I have to have one or two lined up.
Yeah, I'm addicted to caffeine too.
So if you would like to go and make yourself some coffee, and you can bop around the kitchen to Primal Scream with Damaged.
Just you and me, girl, was a beautiful time. Ah, yeah. Said it felt so happy. My. I was through it, died in pain. So
You're listening to Ever Beyond with JP here on Wolf Spirit Radio.
Oh, yes, you are. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. You're listening to Ever Beyond. You're listening to JP and you're listening to Thomas Sheridan. Good evening once again. And, yeah, those of you who are used to tuning in Britain or the UK or anywhere else other than America, yes, the show's an hour earlier. That's due to the daylight saving time nightmare week that I have every spring and every autumn as the time zones move out of step with each other. You'd have thought that everybody would change at the same time, wouldn't you? But no, the rules are different. It's all very complicated. It must have been made by psychopaths. Well, Thomas, What do you think of time zone changes and daylight saving time?
I think the original idea for World War One to give more daylight, so people working in the countryside could do harvests longer. But I think the reality was that they could fight battles in the north of France and Belgium, you know, longer in the day. Yeah, it's very interesting, the whole thing. It's also like the opening hours of pubs in the end of the world. That was done so people couldn't go fight in wars and stuff like that. So they could go fight in wars. They wouldn't want us down the pub being friends with everybody. But it's interesting. I think it's stupid. I don't think there's no reason to keep daylight savings time going. It's just one of these, you know, mind Fs to mess with us at this point. I get caught out every summer, every spring and autumn as well by this bloody thing. And it makes no sense. None at all. Ridiculous at this point in time.
So, I mean, like I said, it messes me up every spring and autumn since I've been doing this radio station, which is based in Nevada, you know. And you'd think that all of America would change time zone at the same time. Yes, except Arizona. One of our hosts comes from Arizona, and she's always completely outstep with everybody because she's in her own time zone, in Arizona. It's a completely crazy thing. They don't have daylight saving time change in Arizona. So
I didn't know that.
Neither did I. Until I started doing this radio thing. So that's a quick... So let's focus ourselves back. I'd like to bring up a question that was brought up by one listener before the show, and she'll be listening to the archive of this. And it's by Maggie, and a lot of our regulars know Maggie. She has been a listener for several years and has worked in a prison situation. And she's often talked about the kind of crazy people that she has actually working in the prison, rather than, you know, just the inmates. You know, it's the old cuckoo's nest kind of thing. So if I could read this out. Now, it's a kind of statement thing, but maybe I think she wants you to kind of make a comment on it. So, right, so I'll just read this. I'll just put in a brief version of what I wanted to say. I worked on the antisocial personality unit, which, according to the DSM-4, is not the same diagnosis as sociopaths. I don't see it as much different. What we're really talking about here is really a type of energy. I often had the sense that there was something feeding off the negative energy being created. I used to see shadow people running up and down the hallway at night. I asked the P's, now that's a Pleiadian collective that's channeled by somebody, about it, and they said there were portals created by the patients so that these entities could come through. Temporary portals. She would see this come over our unit kind of like a wave, and the negativity, a snarling evil kind of energy, and it would manifest itself in the staff as well. If you remove the construct and look at it as energy, it really is no different from than what is happening on a bigger scale with our banking system, governments and multinational corporations. I think the major source of power for these beings is just our lack of awareness that they are present, which is exactly what you were saying, Alf Thomas. Thank you for allowing me to voice my opinions and experience. I look forward to hearing what his perceptions are on this. Now that I don't work on that unit, I'm grateful for the experience, but didn't feel that way at the time. Should be a good show. So that's
from, yeah. Well,
go ahead.
I hear this all the time, and in fact, I've experienced this myself. Firstly, the DSM is muck. It's an absolutely farcical document. It's created for the purpose of, you know, prescribing psychiatric drugs to a whole plethora of disorders. If you were to read the DSM, just about everybody in there would be classified as mentally, like you and I on the show tonight would be diagnosed with oppositional defiancy disorder, meaning that we question the status quo, and of course we'd have to be medicated. So the DSM changes the goalposts all the time. Antisocial personality disorder, sociopath, psychopath, narcissistic personality disorder, borderline person, they're always constantly playing with it. The reality is, I just simplify it. To me, it's just psychopaths and degrees of psychopathology. I think they also misdiagnose people who are not psychopathic or not borderline as borderline and things like that. So I like to keep this thing straight because I think confusion is the quarry of the psychopath. They're always looking to confuse us. And I believe you keep things simple and straight, just like you would in any other sort of wisdom tradition, you'll get to the heart of the matter. Now, this thing of channeling, I don't believe in channeling. I think it's all fraudulent, and I think channelers are all con artists and things like that, or they're delusional. What happens is when they start channeling, even if they think they're sincere, they start listening to the wrong parts of their brain. What happens is a loop of schizophrenia kind of kicks in. So I don't believe in any of that stuff. I know that I do believe we have a collective unconscious, and we do all have an element of telepathy amongst us. But this whole thing of channeling beings from other planets, that's all there. That's, in my opinion, I've never seen any proof of that. And I've never met, I've never met individuals who have any credibility as human beings who do it unless they're unwell and they're schizophrenic. So I don't have this whole thing of portals and all this stuff of aliens coming in. However, Maggie, I would have to agree with her on one level, that there is a historical precedence, a historical and theological precedent for this idea of a non-human consciousness of a kind of a parasitic infection that lives on this planet with the rest of us, that doesn't so much jump into a human who is a quote-unquote portal, but it's a normal human. You know, it actually targets you know, them in the womb. That actually the personality jumps in there, very similar to the changeling kind of idea that you get within there, like Celtic culture and stuff like that. Yes, is there something to this? The Gnostics called them the Archons. John Lash has done some very good work into this, and Jay Widener talks about it a lot as well. I've actually started studying it a lot myself lately, and I actually believe that the Gnostics, when they talked about Archons, were talking about a psychopathic bureaucracy, almost like what I was talking about at the beginning, where a control structure, just by its very nature of a hierarchical control structure, becomes psychopathic in its function, in its way of being. Now, what Maggie was saying about this sort of supernatural aspect of the psychopath, yes, lots of people have told me this. There's some very spooky things, like psychopath's ability to fall asleep and wake up instantly. And they don't wake up like a normal person would wake up, where you kind of stretch up and you move into the day. They wake up instantaneously like that. Instant alertness. There's no fatigue. They instantly wake up. Very, very spooky. Almost like a program of some kind is being switched on inside a biological robot, which is spooky. I've never heard a thing about the shadow people, but these kinds of things fascinate me too, because I think we're ultimately dealing with psychological archetypes here to convey the experience. What I think what happened, Maggie, is, and other people have spoke about this as well, I'm not the first one, is that the psychopaths are so energetically different. Just like Maggie said, they're energetically different. They function on a very different energetic level. Now, I don't like, well, being sort of new age or anything, religious or anything like that. Yes, we do. We are a biochemical machine. Ultimately, we're an electromagnetic, happenstance within the sort of like quantum matrix. Yeah, that's all true. We all know that stuff. And psychopaths definitely have a different energy, and they have ability to switch that energy around. So, when she was seeing the shadow people, and I'm not going to diagnose this situation or try and tell Maggie that she wasn't, feeling, her feelings weren't genuine. But I think a lot of these experiences are normal people, normal empathic human beings like her. Her psychology and her physiology warning her of the danger present. It seems to happen like that. It's very similar to a poltergeist experience, where a poltergeist is usually a teenage girl going through puberty, no man in the house, in a dysfunctional home, and things start flying around. It's the young girl is actually changing the electromagnetic spectrum of her environment as a means of dealing with the fact that she's going through these hormonal changes with no father figure. Maggie may have experienced the same thing, but I don't discount that she actually saw real things too as well. So I'm not, good luck to her. But yes, I've heard, I have a friend, well, not a friend, but someone I was talking to here, a prison officer who worked with in here in Ireland as well, in the prison service, in a maximum security place in Dublin. And he said that, like, he knew who the psychopaths were the minute they came in, even if they weren't diagnosed. He said that you just feel it from them. They were not like the other prisoners. The other prisoners you could become friends with, have a chat with, you feel comfortable. Even if they were murderers, they're criminals. If they were not psychopaths, you still would relate to them as a human being. He said you could always tell the psychopathic ones, and their sense of logic would be so strange. He told me once about that there was this psychopath who was sharing a cell with a convicted paedophile, and as soon as the convicted boy went into the cell, the psychopath strangled him with the electric cord, the power cord off a tape off a cassette player, and then went out and boasted to everyone that he killed a paedophile, and thinking it was going to get him out of prison or have a sentence reduced. That's the logic of the psychopath. They're very absurd as well. He thought that he could impress people by killing a pedophile, a notorious pedophile. He didn't, he just thought it'd make him look really like a hero or something, not knowing that he'd probably have another 10 years onto a sentence. But this is what they're like. Yes, I think Maggie has hit some very powerful names on the head. I don't buy into the sort of flying saucerism of this kind of thing, space aliens and all this garbage. I don't go for any of that stuff. I mean, I'm not saying it's garbage. I mean, yeah, those things exist, but I don't, if the aliens exist, they have no, why would they be interested in this planet? I mean, with, you know, what's so special about us? Nothing. But I do believe that she experienced real events, and I totally respect her feelings and what those psychopaths did being around them. So yeah, that was a great question. I'd love to actually meet someone like Maggie and talk about this stuff, because I'm very interested in these sort of supernatural happenstances which take place in the company of these things. Like, I've one friend, I don't want to keep harping on about this. He's a detective in New Scotland Yard in London. And this is a guy who deals with like hardened criminals in South London. He brings gangsters. You know, this guy carries a gun, goes in, busts gangsters, big time criminals he deals with. And he used to work in the Child Protection Services of New Scotland Yard. And he said half the paedophiles that came in, they were questioning, they were psychopaths. And he said he could tell after a certain while, because something would happen. If they came into the interrogation cell, the room would go cold. He said there was a noticeable drop in temperature, and also a failure of electronic equipment. It was, things would happen like when they used to use cassette tapes, that tape would jam or wouldn't record. He said even with digital recorders, things would go wrong. And he said there was one guy who said he was the most extreme psychopath he ever met. And he said to me, Thomas, he's not human. This guy was not human. He was a possessed demon or something. And he said to me, Dad, this guy at 70 years old, he was a notorious sex criminal, at 70 years old could jump from the ground of a cell up into a 4-foot ledge, 7 feet off the ground, from without a running start, just jump up in the air like and land on the ledge. And he used to do that and masturbate 20 times a day at age 70. And so that's, yeah, I've heard these stories. It is a very spooky thing, and it is a very it's something I do want to look at further. It's almost like supernatural effects of the psychopath.
Yeah, and well, I mean, it may be that this overactive hypothalamus, reptilian epinephrine, I can never pronounce that one. But like with loads of that jacked into your system, you do impossible things because you know it shoots your adrenaline up and you become like almost like a superhuman, but you're incredibly tense. It's a bit it's a bit like Speedhead or something like that. You see, now it's interesting because Maggie did have a sort of supplementary question, because that was a kind of statement that she made. So, and you have answered some of them, but I'll just throw these out because it's interesting. You did bring up a lot of what she was talking about. Here it goes. I would want to know if it is his perception as well. Does he think that these sociopaths are involved in the dark arts? Does he think it's a brain disorder? Should our leaders have brain scans? What does he think of the DSM-4 as a diagnostic tool? Oh, we heard that. I personally think it's very subjective. I think the work he does into bringing this into our awareness is very important.
Well, firstly, I want to thank Maggie for that. And that's, yeah, I agree that DSM-4 is unbelievably subjective. It's almost like a piece of sheet music. You can play it. You can play it any way you want, depending on the style of the musician or the psychiatrist who's using it or whatever. Yeah, I've no faith in the DSM, mainly because the main reason I've no faith, and none of us should have any faith in the DSM, is because there's something like 44 or 47 professionals, and half of them are from drug companies, who meet behind the closed doors. They sign a non-disclosure agreement on what they've actually spoken about behind closed doors, and then they produce this document that the whole world is supposed to abide by, yet there's absolutely no accountability, and half the people involved are from drug companies. That's the real reason we should ignore the DSM. Now, what was the second thing Maggie said then? What else did she say?
Yeah, sure. Does he think these sociopaths are involved in the dark arts?
Well, that's an interesting one. It depends on what the dark arts are. I mean, there's some people who would consider Wicca or paganism or anything like that to be the dark arts if they were a Christian.
No. We're talking about like rituals where you stab and hurt people, you know.
Oh, yeah, I think they're into all that stuff. Well, yeah, I think that's why the ones in power, I think a lot of the ones in power behind closed door. I think Stanley Kubrick blew the whistle on that with the movie Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah, I think, you see, we're back to what was said about the Nazis earlier on. The Nazis were, they could do whatever they wanted, so there was no restraints. So the powerful, very wealthy psychopaths behind closed doors, God knows what they get up to. You know, we had the Hellfire Club in both London and Dublin during the Georgian era. And, you know, I mean, I saw a documentary about the Hellfire Club recently, the one in Dublin, and they had this old guy. He meant well, but he was just an idiot. And he was saying things like, oh, they did things like, you know, they used to play poker and they'd have, like, they'd drink till all hours. No, they did things much worse than that. These are aristocrats who are doing things like having sex rituals with black African slaves, murdering them, all kinds of things like that were going on up in this place. And the same as the one in London, huge amounts of opium being smoked. Yes, I do believe something. I agree. They're involved. Yeah, I do. They can get away with it. And the police can't find them, and they have the money and power to do it. Absolutely, they'll do it. Yep, she's right.
Okay, and so breaking this down, does he think it's a brain disorder? Well, you're saying earlier that it's a different order.
Yeah, when you think of a brain disorder, you think of something that's broken. You know, you think of actually brain damage. Like my friend who had the motorcycle accident, he has a brain disorder because he's had an accident. You know, if you look at their brains, other than an MRI scan, nothing is missing. None of the cerebral partitions are damaged. There's nothing broken there. There's nothing damaged. There's nothing missing. Even when they have the septum removed, lots of normal people have a missing septum as well. And they can still damper somehow the norepinephrine because of their underlying personality. No, I believe that it's actually, I've been saying this for a while now. It's a predatory consciousness. It's another form of human being that's like a parasitic individual, a different kind of human consciousness. I'm talking about a non-material consciousness now, not something manifested in the brain. Actually, none of us actually are really in our brains. Our brains and our nervous system are just a receiver transmission system to exist in this reality. But they are a predatory consciousness that are operating up through a human body in the same way a ventriloquist hand works a dummy, and they have no need for compassion or empathy or any of that stuff, so they don't bother with their prefrontal cortex, their amygdala, or their limbic regions. They just have no use for them.
Well, that's interesting.
Everything works. Everything is in there. Everything works. They just don't use it.
That's interesting. That brings up a question that came from the chat room from Hulk. Does he believe that these sociopaths are being controlled by other dimensional entities? And, you know, we've seen Avatar. We get the idea.
Well, you know, I try to stay as conservative as possible when dealing with this stuff, because I'm trying to sell the message to a sort of a mainstream audience, because ultimately my first objective is to protect ordinary people from being abused by these creatures, and if they have, how to recover from them. Yeah, so that I have to be very conservative in how I do this stuff. But do I believe that when you say other entities, you mean like other forms of consciousness? Let me put it this way. I don't rule that out, as far as I'll go. But I do not rule that out. I would never say it publicly. I would never, you know, come out and, you know, and announce these kinds of things. But there is evidence to suggest that another consciousness or another entity, but a very different kind of human, if even that, experiences behind it. That's based right now at this point in time. That's about as far as I could go. So I'm not discounting it, and I'm not pushing it either.
You're not ruling the possibility out. Okay, very good. Yeah. I get your point of view.
I don't want to alienate people from this important message, because you know a lot of people who would not be open to the stuff that guys like you and I and listeners of the show would be open to, but they still need help. You know, there's people who are Christians and Muslims and Jews who would have a very, you know, an atheist. They still need this information to help them. So I have to be very, very careful how I present it.
Yeah.
I don't want to alienate anybody or anything like that, but I do agree that everything should be open for discussion with this particular subject.
Yes, well, we have to, the thing is with our show and with our audience, they're all pretty switched on and are aware of all the stuff that we're talking about and kind of beyond. So they're quite an open-minded and hearted audience. But
well, I'll tell you, yeah. There's something else that's interesting. I recently did a speaking tour of Scandinavia, and I was talking very much into a mainstream audience there. And a lot of people, there was doctors and all kinds of engineers and other kind of people in the audience. And just, you know, I did a very kind of clinical presentation, 3-hour presentation on psychopathology and blah, and the usual thing. And I threw in little bits here and there about the Gnostics and the Archons. It's sort of a mythological archetype of the possibility that, you know, other traditions saw psychopathic individuals, although they didn't call them psychopaths. They would have called them things like moral imbeciles and stuff like that, or demonically possessed. But this belief in an other kind of consciousness controlling them. And I was amazed at how many of these people came up and said, you know, it does make sense that there's a non-human consciousness in there. And these are people who were like doctors and stuff like that. So, and I mean, as I told you, my friend is a Scotland Yard detective. He refuses to believe that psychopaths are even human.
So, yeah, so, and exactly what makes a human, you know, here we are, we're walking around in this body, as Thomas calls it, a skin suit, and experiencing the world and responding to the world, but, you know, a lot of us, and I'm sure, you know, I've certainly felt it, that, you know, I'm kind of inside this rather than I am this being sitting here, and, you know.
It's definitely, you know, this is like the analogy of the TV, like Rupert Sheldrake talks about, the consciousness operates like a television. You know, there's a television signal and then the television allows the program to be visible. I think that's, well, actually, there's a huge amount of information to prove that's true. So, yeah, I agree with that. If you have a sort of, well, look at it this way, Jay, you have everything in nature has a duality to it. There's protons, neutrons, up, down, male, female, negative, positive, black, white. Well, why wouldn't it be empathic consciousness and predatory consciousness? That's the way I look at it.
Well, indeed. And this is another aspect of the duality that we find ourselves in. And, you know, it sometimes seems a bit overwhelming, you know, that, you know, little sultanas of nice, squishy, empathic people surrounded by a cake of psychopathy. And another one.
Well, it's actually the other way around. So, the vast majority of us are empathic, but we don't bother causing trouble. We have this small infection of psychopaths around us, and they're the ones who are causing the problem. So it's really the other way around.
Chocolate chip psycho.
Yeah, but it does seem overwhelming at times.
Yeah, chocolate chips. You can really taste them. Oh, lovely. So, where were we? Wolfman J, give him Steve Richards' name. Steve Richards?
Never heard of him.
Never heard of him. There we go. Hulk. Anyway, where are we? I'm just winding back to see if there's any other any questions in the chat room, because it's very lively, I have to say. You just kind of brushed on it, you know, that in days gone by you'd have called it pixelation, you know, being hypnotized by pixies, or you'd have called it demonic possession and things like that. How close do you, I mean, if these people, beings, have been with us for very long, they would have been known in history, but also they would also write themselves out of history, wouldn't they?
If they had control. Well, they've done that, haven't they? I mean, they've done that. It's not until recent times, in the last, since World War II, and then not even then, it took years for it to happen. It's only, they've written themselves out of history. There was nothing written about psychopaths until 100 years ago. And then any books or documents written about them would always refer to the psychopaths as being among the poor. among the poor and among the immigrant groups. They were very racist, actually, and very class-driven, and they would completely ignore the J.P. Morgans and people like that. So they have been written out of history. It's only in the last... You see, we're living in an amazing time. We're the first... You know, prior to us, there would have been things like socialists and communists who would point to the top of the pyramid. You know, it was always about a workers' kind of bosses' struggle. But for the first time in history, we are living in amazing times, that we're an actual people who's not seeing things in religious, social, class, or ethnic terms. We're actually seeing in a human terms, in terms of the human species. So the only reason they could have managed that for so long is to have written out of history. And the fact that they slaughtered both the Gnostics and the Cathars, who were very aware of the fact that there were human beings amongst us who were not us, they were a different kind of human being, who were cruel and vicious, and they had their own terms for them. And, you know, they murdered those people in their millions, ruthlessly murdered them. Proves that there is, and also remember, how many indigenous people have they killed? Indigenous people were very aware of psychopaths. They were very aware of psychopathology. You know, particularly, you know, in these islands, the Druids, look at the enormous logistical efforts the Romans went through to get onto the island of Anglesey during a time of economic downturn in Roman Britain and slaughter the last of the Druids. So they've written themselves out of history big time. And any indigenous or wisdom tradition that was aware of them, such as the Bernadette in Italy, you know, back in the 1700s, in the 15 and 1600s, they were ruthlessly suppressed and written out of history by the Jesuits, because the Bernadette were aware that there was an effect in the material world that was related to a sort of a pollution of the consciousness in the spirit world. So yeah, they've written themselves out of history, and it's only since possibly the internet that we've actually been able to develop this sort of indigenous sort of a revival and understanding that people amongst us, particularly the top of the pyramid, are a different kind of human being.
That's fascinating, Thomas. That's very fascinating. We have also, as many guests on our show, Native Americans. We call them Native Turtle Islanders, rather than calling, you know, because America is a... as an old, you know, sort of a fake term. And you know, they have shared some of their knowledge. And one of the things that they've told us that we never knew about is the massive slaughter, the Indian Holocaust, where dozens of millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of Native Indians have been slaughtered because they hold the tradition.
Yep.
They hold the truth.
That's what happened, and that's why those people were killed. That's because you think about it, what is Western civilization? Western civilization is the annihilation of the native. That's all Western civilization is. The annihilation, eradication, and extinction of the native. They began with the Druids, they went through the Gnostics and the Cathars, then they went through the shamans in the West, they destroyed Africa, and they destroyed the Americas. Now, what's interesting about the Americas is, the only major civilization, the most brutal civilization that arose in the Americas was the Aztecs. These guys were even more murderous than the Europeans. And the leaders of the Aztecs used to believe that they were in communication with demons, and the demons were the ones who were telling them to slaughter, in some instances, up to 50,000 people in 4 days, as sacrifice to the gods. So yes, and who did the Aztecs target? They targeted Mayans. They targeted even up as far as Navajo up in the Americas. They went after other natives. The native peoples know the truth. In fact, the Eskimos, the Inuit people of North America, who are also natives on Turtle Island as well, the term in their language for a psychopath is he who's, you know, it more or less translates to he who steals our stuff and forces himself upon our women while we are out hunting for our children. They are very aware. There are no psychopaths in indigenous traditions. They do not exist because they're rooted out at a very early age, or they're seen. They take them on a hunting trip and they'll meet with an accident because the survival of the tribe is too vital to risk on one of these things in there. Western civilization from the time of Babylon on has been nothing other than the annihilation of wisdom traditions. And why? Because wisdom traditions know about the psychopaths. And now with the internet, we finally are almost becoming a sort of a digital native. That's what people like us are. We listen to your show and all these other shows like this. These now hundreds, if not thousands, of programs like this on the internet radio. We are a new native tradition. And think about it, it makes perfect sense. The internet is almost becoming an extension of our neuroelectrical system. We're actually developing a new kind of brain. We're almost evolving through the internet. It's ironic that the ultimate creation of technology, the internet, has actually restored the native.
That's a very lovely way of putting it, Thomas. You know, and it's true, because when we're talking on Wolf Spirit Radio, we always feel like we're just people talking around a campfire.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, I certainly have my wood fire burning here in the corner here, and I hope you're nice and cozy in Dublin there. So, Hulk is telling you to look at holographic kinetics with Steve Richards. So I'll pass that name to you if you.
Yeah, I'll check that out. Sounds interesting. Anything like that, I'm very interested in. So thanks to the listener for suggesting that.
There you go, Hulk. Right. So let's just have a look. Yes. Oh God, well, it's been very lively. We've been chatting away. And I'm looking for more questions from different people. So far, Hulk has been putting lots of things in there. Is anybody calling? So, yes. Now, there was another interesting thing. It's back to the eyes and this idea that... there is a magnetic property. Mesmer used to call it, animal magnetism. And you also said, that there was there's often a crackling energy around people like this, they make machines go wrong. Actually, I'm a computer guy. I fix computers, and I certainly have experienced people who make machines go wrong just by their beingness. There's whatever they do, boom, the whole thing, and they have to cycle through computers faster than anybody else because they just blow all the time. And I can sense that energy from them. It is a rather intense energy than we experience from them. And there is a kind of psychic field around certain people, and people would call that charisma. And you also noted earlier that when they stepped into the room, it got noticeably colder, which means that energy is being drawn away from you. That's why you feel cold. There's a sense of this is like one of these vortex hoovers that's just sucking the life out of everything.
Yeah, well, you think about, like, an old-fashioned house that doesn't have central heating, and you have a fire on, like, a range or something, an aga or some kind of, like, a fuel, open fire, whatever, and you have the doors closed. Well, that would be an empathic person, and then someone opens the door to the corridor or to another room, and the cold comes rushing in. Well, it's not really the cold that's rushing in. It's the, it's a thermal exchange. The heat is actually rushing out. And that's what happens when we're around these people. They actually suck us dry. They actually damage us on that level. They're sucking our energy. There's a huge element of energy vampirism going on there. The eyes seem to play a huge part in that because they will make very intense eye contact and very focused. Now, this is when they're pretending to be charming as well. They'll do it. They're very good at seduction. And they're very good at seducing people sexually. And what they do is they will stare into a person's eyes, and they will look at the psychopath will take very careful note of the pupil dilation, because when particularly a woman hears something that makes her feel good or relaxed, her pupils will dilate because of oxytocin hormone being released in the brain. And the psychopath will be looking intensely into her eyes and saying certain things, bringing up certain subjects. And when he notices a dilation of the pupils in her eyes, he will remain on that subject or that line of discussion because it's resonating with her. He's then aware that dopamine levels in her brain are now increasing, and she's enjoying the experience of talking to this guy. You see, it's very spooky stuff, Jay. And he knows exactly that he has this person hooked. I call it a form of chemical warfare, because they're aware of chemical changes in our brain and how to manipulate them. And that's what he's doing. And that's the energy that people talk about. They had to be involved with a sexual relationship with one of these people. It can be a very intense sexuality, very often violent, often non-stop, constant sexual activity, all ongoing, but no sense of bonding. They don't make love. They don't know how to make love. They have a machine copulation about them. And people who are having sex with them think that they're having sex with them all the time because they really care about me and they just really fancy me and they can't stop thinking about me. No, they're using the sex as a chemical warfare to fire up chemicals in people's brains. That's why people will always say, you know, when they first meet a psychopath, they say, my God, the sex life of this guy or this woman is incredible. But when the relationship ends and they look back and they think to themselves and they say, well, it was very robotic and cold. There was no sense of intimacy there. That's because the psychopath was sucking all the energy out of a person while they were doing it.
So, yeah, that's, and that's a hairy subject, isn't it? That, you know, you finally ended up in bed with, in the sack with one.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a bad Saturday night. That really is. Hulk is.
This is where the vampire comes from.
Goes what?
This is where the vampire comes from. Bram Stoker, the guy who wrote Dracula, he was a theatrical agent for a British actor called Henry Irving, who, by all accounts, was most likely a psychopath. He had sex with women constantly and drove them insane. Many of the women were just driven insane. He would have sex with women all over the place, wherever he went in the world, and then discard them. And these women were destroyed and broken. And the idea of Dracula came from Bram Stoker witnessing Henry Irving's effect upon women.
Ah. Interesting. And isn't there some connection with Henry Irving and the princes?
Yeah, he was tied up with that old king. He got a knighthood as well very early on. Yeah, he was tied up with the, you know, the British ruling class big time. In fact, even the American ruling class, he was, you know, friends of several American presidents, stayed in the White House. And he made a slave of this guy, Bram Stoker. Now, when Bram Stoker stopped being his theatrical, Bram Stoker was probably gay and had an infatuation with Irving, and Irving used him for that reason. In fact, Irving went to Dublin and Stoker was just a civil servant in Dublin Castle, and Henry Irving gave a performance of Hamlet. What happened was the next day, Stoker wrote a review for the Irish Times praising his performance, and Henry Irving invited him to a special dinner. And if you read Bram Stoker's notes about how Henry Irving wooed and enchanted Bram Stoker at this dinner in the hotel, it's exactly how a psychopath works. The unbelievable charm and flattery, the whole laying it on thick of how wonderful he is, and offering him a job on the spot. But all poor Bram Stoker got out of it was to become a slave.
Yes, we have to be very careful of great offers that are offered. Everything seems too good to be true. And that's a very interesting parallel that you're drawing. I mean, we could say that the vampire mythology is another version of the same story.
That's why the TV is full of all these sex vampire shows, like Twilight and all this garbage in recent years. They're pushing the psychopath to the fore. You see, we're literally, when people talk about the Battle of Armageddon, I often think we're in it right now. Well, it's between the psychopath and the rest of us. And they're using all their arsenals and all their weapons. And their weapon at the moment is culture. And their weapon and their need now is to try and normalize the psychopath as the de facto human being or the de facto human behavior in the world. And that's why they flood our TV programs and our movies, everything from vampire shows to this Joker and Batman, with psychopaths.
And Greenheart in the chat room saying, the one movie I ever watched with my psychopathic landlord was, of course, Bram Stoker's Dracula. So, yeah, that's it all been there. Hey, Free Sovereign, hello. And thank you, Jamesy, for posting the references to Bram Stoker in the chat room. So it's a very lively, lively response you're getting here on the chat room here, Thomas. And
good, I'm delighted to hear that.
Yes, it's like a comet's the comet's tail going behind us, and the subjects are being picked up and they're all woven into the to the chatter. It's lovely.
That's what we want: discourse,
that's dialogue. We indeed want. So here's the thing: you've written several books. Can we just kind of do a little focus on the evolution of your books in the last few minutes? Yeah. So, like, you know, sure. The first book was about this.
If you're going to read my books, read them in order. The first one is Puzzling People: The Labyrinth of the Psychopath. That deals with the issue of psychopathology in your life of people who may have come into contact with you. It is a toolkit designed to focus in on, you know, is this person who's messed my life up or causing me problems a psychopath? It allows you to identify them. It gives you a sort of a coat of armor and a toolkit which allows you to stop psychopaths from preying on you for the rest of your life. That's the first one. The second one is called Defeat of Demons. It takes it to the next stage. It looks at psychopathology in a social context. It also looks at it in terms of mythology and archetypes. And also, it's a much deeper dive into the science and stuff like that. Puzzling People is an instant kind of like, wham, bam, here's what you need to know manual. The second one is a bit deeper. It's more of a philosophical insight into the whole issue. So if you like that kind of thing, that would be a good one to start with too. You want to look at this sort of like the richness of it in terms of archetypes, and I talk about the attack on native. In fact, I start Defeat of Demons with a story of what happened to Druids in Anglesey at the hands of the Romans. Funny enough, brings us right back to where we started on this show. And my third book, which came out a few months ago, The Anvil of the Psyche, talks about how these pathological structures within media, and particularly the creation of false culture, is used against us. I talk about everything from pop music to how financial data is twisted, to even how John Lennon was assassinated twice. So, you know, I would start at Puzzling People and just work your way through them if you want to read them. But my books are ultimately a suit of armor to help people have a safer and happier and more interesting life. They're not fear-based. I often use humor. I'm a satirist as well. I constantly use humor to deal with problems and to deal with issues, because that's part of my sort of creative artistic path as well. I think the satirist is an extremely important way to deal with this. You remember when you put a deck of cards back into the pack, the Joker always trumps the court cards. So we should never lose our sense of humor. We should never lose our ability to laugh about ourselves and the world around us, because that's actually keeping us safe. That sort of gallows humor is very important. We should not be afraid to laugh at the control system and see the absurdity of the psychopath. It's very important. My first book, Puzzling People, ends with sort of like real life references to psychopaths, just to show how stupid and absurd they are when you're away from them and they can't play games on you. So that's my three books: Puzzling People, Defeat the Demons, and The Anvil of the Psyche. And they're all available on Amazon and all the online bookstores, and some book chains as well. And I'm also currently, at the moment now, I'm currently researching a new book. It won't come out this year. It'll probably be late next year, to do with the confusion between spiritual awakening and mental illness, because, and also political awakening as well, because I'm very interested. I'm meeting a lot of people on my talks, on my travels, who've lost their friends, lost, even had divorces tragically, because they've had a spiritual or social awakening. They've woken up, but their friends or their partners haven't. And it's often confused that these people are going nuts, and sometimes their friends convince them that they're nuts. So I want to create a guidebook that will help people wake up gently, and also for their friends and family to understand that, like, if your brother or your sister or your best friend has suddenly taken an interest in the subjects we talk about on these TV stations, it's not the end of the world. They're just going through a sort of a change in their lives, a kind of sort of like a consciousness maturity. So I'm really excited about that. Ultimately, all my work is about the same thing, the protection of human consciousness going forward. Hopefully, to allow us to evolve to the next stage of humanity.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? This is the essence of the opposing force of the evolving human, because in the company of psychopaths, it's very difficult to exhibit those qualities which we call evolved, because they'll just eat it.
Well, if psychopaths never existed, we would have never had the combustion engine as long as that we have. They've, you know, things like that where they've made us keep the combustion engine in order to keep the oil industry going. Things like that wouldn't have never existed. We would have been flying around in airplanes by the Renaissance. We would have been exploring Mars and other planets by the, you know, the Victorian era. They've actually damaged us, and they've actually stunted us as a species. They're holding us back. We have to get these clowns out of our lives, out of and out of corporations. We have to ignore them and start going on our, you know, we should have, the world is full of energy, and yet they still push the combustion engine and the turbine in our face. There's so many things, ways out of this. This is why this issue is so important, because we as human beings have been robbed of possibly up to 3,000 or 4,000 years of evolution by the psychopath rising to the top of the structure at the time of Babylon 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. We've got to get these idiots out, and we've got to get human evolution back on course. It begins with political, social, spiritual, cultural evolution, but ultimately these guys are like the clog in the drain. We've got to get the psychopath out so human evolution can start flowing again naturally.
Oh, what a very interesting thought there, because that is, you know, all my Facebook friends know I had literally a clog in the drain about 3 days ago, and it was in a place that only the farmer knew, because I've only just moved into this place, and everything was flooding up, and it was rather disgusting. So I know all about what happens when there's something stuck in the drain. Synchronicity indeed. Thomas Sheridan, it has been an honor and a pleasure for my mind and my heart to speak with you today. Thank you for the work that you've been doing, and I'd like to thank from all the chatters in the chat room. For instance, this guy is brilliant. And you know, stuff like that. So I hope you're feeling the love there, Thomas. And with that, I'm going to close the program. And next up will be Frank Jordan and the Healings and Meditations Group. So let's try using that mouse there. That's the one. Two computers. Okay. Thank you very much, and good night.
Thank you, Jay.
Beyond.